All good, Sam? Yep. Good evening. My name is Paula Reet, Mayor of Kingborough. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all to this evening's meeting on Monday the 6th of March. Very warm welcome to all the members who are in the public gallery tonight, and I'm sure there are others watching along at home on YouTube. Being 5:30pm, I now officially declare the meeting open. I wish to advise that Council's meetings are recorded and made publicly available on our website. In accordance with Council's policy, I'd ask the General Manager to confirm that the recording has started.
Confirm, Mayor.
Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, pay respects to Elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Reet, Deputy Mayor Councillor Gladewright, Councillor Antoli, Councillor Bain, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Richardson, Councillor Street. From our staff this evening, we have the General Manager, Mr Arnold, the Director of Engineering Services, Mr Reeve, Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr Smee, the Director of Environment, Development and Community Services, Dr Fox, the Manager of Development Services, Ms Tyler Moore, our Media and Communications Advisor, Ms Adams, and our Executive Assistant, Mrs Morton. We have apologies this evening from Councillor Midgley. On page one, the motion is that the minutes of the open session of Council meeting number 3, held on the 20th of February 2023, be confirmed as a true record. Looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. Moving now to page two, workshops held since the last Council meeting. We had a workshop on the 27th of February in relation to the dog management policy and also the Local Government Association of Tasmania's Workplace Health and Safety Review. On page two now, declarations of interest. Does any councillor have a declaration of interest? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a declaration for 13.1, item 13.1, DA 2022-321. And upon the advice of the General Manager, I'll be recusing myself from the room.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Any further declarations? Thank you. We'll move on. Transfer of agenda items. Is there any item on the agenda that a councillor wishes to transfer from closed into open session or open into closed session? No? Thank you. Questions without notice from the public. Does any member of the public with us here this evening, would you like to ask a question without notice? Thank you. If you'd like to come to the lectern and just state your name and address before asking a question, please. If you could just turn the light on so we can hear, just on the front, should say talk. Oh. Thank you very much.
Charles Biggins, Leslie Barr. Questions regarding biodiversity offset policy. At last Council meeting, there appeared to be some confusion about when the amended policy, August 22, can be implemented regarding Councillor Cordova's queries at last Council meeting, as it is yet to be incorporated into the interim planning scheme. Has Council, acting as planning authority, been implementing the amended policy since August 22? If so, how many development applications has it been applied to, and have the affected persons been advised of this oversight?
Thank you, Mr. Biggins. Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, the amended version hasn't been used for the decision making. It's the current version that exists in the scheme that is used.
Thank you. My other questions relate to the up-and-coming trees on private property bylaw that the General Manager advised us at last Council meeting that he had the certificate to proceed with. The draft bylaw has already been drafted. When will this be presented to Council? Will there be an opportunity for public comment and consultation? And will tree experts be consulted regarding the content of the draft bylaw?
Ms. Tullamore. Oh, sorry. Mr. Smee. Beg your pardon.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, the next stage in the process to put the bylaw out for public comment.
And Will tree experts or arborists be consulted regarding the content? Basically, has there been expert input into the content of the draft?
Through you, Mayor, staff from our Environmental Services Department have consulted with a range of experts in relation to the development of the bylaw, and obviously anyone with expertise in any area is welcome to make a submission when it goes out for public comment.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions? If not, we'll move on. Oh, sorry. If you'd like to come to the lectern and give your name and address, please. Could you just turn the light on just by pressing the talk button on the top? Thank you very much.
Good evening. My name's Josh Graham Evans from Hobart. I'd like to ask some questions on behalf of Ange Hanley from NECA, who's in the public gallery tonight, and on behalf of 700 members of the Facebook group Kingborough Residents Concerned About the Landscape Conservation Zoning. Whilst I currently reside in Hobart, I grew up on a farm in Woodbridge and I have family connections throughout Kingborough. My second cousin owns a multi-generational farming property in Woodbridge. Part of that working property has been targeted with the new highly restrictive landscape conservation zoning. My question is Council aware of the Good Governance Guide for Local Government in Tasmania, and does it support the following statement within? Accountability is a fundamental requirement of good governance. Local government has an obligation to report, to explain, and to be answerable for the consequences of decisions made on behalf of the community.
Yes, Council and councillors and council staff are aware of the Good Governance Guide, and yes, we are accountable in accordance with that.
Does Council therefore believe it has an obligation, when asked, to provide objective information to landowners on the consequences of a landscape conservation zoning?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the consultation period will occur for the change to the planning scheme for all zones, overlays, codes and other provisions, and that will be during the public exhibition period, and yes, we will comply with those requests and expectations.
What are the range of potential negative implications for landowners who are rezoned to a landscape conservation zone?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, it depends on what is perceived by an individual about what is a negative. Some people may see that it's a negative, that there's changes occurring to some of the setbacks, and it obviously depends on what your zone you're going from to. So it's not just one zone that's going to landscape conservation, it's a variety of zones, as we have advised the public. So negatives, like I say, are perceived by the owner. Some people think it's a negative that the setbacks can be less. Some people see it as a negative that the subdivision area will be small compared to the zone that they currently have, but obviously that's not the same for all the zones because there are a variety of zones. Some people may see it as a negative that it's changed into discretionary without having to regard to the existing predominantly discretionary route that you have to go through under particular zones now. If there's something specific that is determined to be negative, then I'm happy to answer that.
Dr. Evans.
I would like to ask a few questions about just some of the concerns that people have in relation to the zoning, the landscape conservation zone. Under the landscape conservation zone, practically every planning application, whether it be for residential development or business use, will take a discretionary pathway, which will cost approximately $500 more than a permitted pathway. Is that correct, and will these fees change under the new planning scheme?
Ms Tullamore.
Fees continually change from year to year. The number of applications that go down the discretionary path for the environmental living, which is the predominant zone that it's going from, over 95% of those are discretionary anyway, so I don't see it as a significant change.
Can Council confirm that all discretionary planning applications under the landscape conservation zone will require a completely new type of landscape values assessment under 22.3.3 of the statewide planning provisions, and that if Council considers the application to not be compatible with landscape values, whatever that means, then it will not be approved? In other words, council will have the power to reject any application to build a house, to extend a deck, to build a shed, to install a pool, if council considers the proposal to be incompatible with landscape values based upon a highly subjective assessment, which will be undertaken by council. Is this correct?
Ms. Tullamore.
And through you, Mayor, the discretionary path in planning, which applies to all planning schemes, does have the ability that the decision could go either way, approval or refusal. The application must be assessed against the provisions of the planning scheme relevant to the zone and the code overlays that affect the site. So the planning officers are obviously geared to consider that. It's not a good path to just assume that it's just a fluffy concept. They can't make it very prescriptive because every property is different. So as an example, if the shed is proposed, it's deep within the site, you can't see it from any other neighbouring area, it's on a cleared area, that might be okay. A large aluminium shed 5 metres from the front setback is quite different. Or if it's sitting on a ridgeline, it's quite different. So it's not simple to say that all property is the same and the application is the same. The landscape in some areas is the very beautiful cleared areas that are paddocks and the like, and that's part of the landscape. That's typical of many parts of Kingborough and the Huon Valley as well, where you go around, and that is the landscape, and it might have a treed landscape, ridgeline at the top, and then cleared areas, and that's what you would expect. So in the context of that, then the sheds and the houses and so forth might be appropriate. Or the assessment may assess whether those buildings are sitting together. If the area was all completely bush and somebody wants to put a 10 metre by 15 metre shed right in the middle of that, in that non-cleared area, then maybe that's not appropriate for the landscape. But if it's sitting in amongst other properties and in context of what is around it, then it might be appropriate. So you can't simply just say it's the same rule for all. That's why every application is assessed on its own merits. We look at what exists, we look at what's nearby, we look at where you can see it from, we look at what the other outcomes might be, such as endangered species, flora, fauna, obviously they're a consideration. It depends if there's a waterway going through, if it's appropriate to put a shed that's going to divert the waterway. It also depends if there's any natural hazards in the area. We have many in Kingborough, including landscape, bushfire, flooding, waterways, coastal hazards and so forth. So there's a whole range of different elements that must be considered for every application. So the assessment is done on that. And that's why to some it seems that they are fluffy assessments, but you can't be prescriptive if you want to apply it to all the different types of properties. Something that's appropriate in an urban area of Blackmans Bay is very different to what might occur in a bush setting.
Dr. Evans.
Can Council confirm that it will control any and all criteria used to make landscape value assessments under 22.3.3 of the statewide planning provisions? And would it also be within the powers of Council to change these criteria over time?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I don't understand the question. When you refer to criteria, are you referring to performance criteria?
Well, to clarify, I would say that any guidance that Council maintains in-house to assist planners in making a determination under the performance criteria.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor. Sorry, can you ask the question again then? So it's about the skills that planners have to do the assessment. Will we change that?
I'm not talking about skills, I'm talking about how Council will assess each of the performance criteria in making a determination. Is there any extra criteria or guidance that will be given to planners maintained in-house? Or is it just made up on each case?
Ms. Tullamore.
No, assessments. We do assessments now against performance criteria and the acceptable solutions, so it's not made up. It comes from experience of dealing with applications. There's always ongoing learning of staff. All staff are tertiary qualified in the area of planning. So there's a lot more to the assessment than just reading and interpretation, and I can appreciate why when a person not from a development or planning or growth type area can read it and say, well, it'd be hard to apply that. But there's a whole lot of planning principles that go into learning and studying planning and that are applied. There's always ongoing learning as well about outcomes. There's reviews of developments. We do review development when it occurs. Was it a good outcome? Was it a bad outcome? And I can assure you, for any council, there's always good examples of good and bad of things that have been approved. And there's ongoing learning with any tribunal decisions that might come out or any decisions come out of the Magistrates Court as a result of illegal works as well.
Dr. Evans.
So to clarify on the last question, you don't maintain any body of knowledge or criteria that helps guide planners when making a determination against performance criteria?
Ms. Tullamore.
We absolutely hold a body of knowledge when we do the assessments.
Just a couple more questions. In order to support a discretionary planning application on the landscape conservation zone, can Council confirm whether or not landowners will be required to procure the services of a landscape consultant to complete a landscape values impact report or similar? I'm not sure what that may be called. And whether the cost of such reports is likely to be in the range of $3,000 to $5,000 or more for projects that are as simple as a deck extension.
Ms. Tullamore.
No, I don't see that it's likely. It's not stipulated in performance criteria that it's particularly required. There are parts of the planning scheme that are very specific about the needing to get professional reports, such as the landslide code and other elements such as that. So not necessarily. It depends on the design, but really you'd hope that the person you've appointed to do the design for you has considered that and can consider whether the that sort of assessment is required. An example of that would be Villa Howden development, which was going to have, I think it was in order of 200 visitor accommodations, and it was appropriate in that instance that there was some landscape considerations in their design and how it was going to respond to that. The question specifically you asked was about a deck. No, it would be unrealistic that we would ask for a professional report on landscape design for that, and in many instances the deck wouldn't actually trigger the need for a permit, but there are instances that it would.
Dr. Evans.
When asked by members of the community what the impacts of the landscape conservation zoning will be, why has Council not to date referred to Table 22.3.3 of the statewide planning provisions? And why has due attention not been given to this table in Council documentation, including the landscape conservation zoning information? Basically, why has Table 22.3.3 and the issues around it not been highlighted at recent Council information sessions on the landscape conservation zoning and in Council fact sheets on zoning?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I don't believe it's correct that it wasn't referred to at all. The tables were presented to most people and provided a copy of that, and often they were run through each of the tables, so I'm not too sure what that is. Perhaps there was some people that didn't note it. Maybe there were some that we didn't point it out for whatever reason. It's not hidden. It's clearly there. It's clearly written in the documentation. The information sheet that was provided attracts interesting attention. Some people believed that it was far too complicated, too much jargon and too much information. Other people criticised it for having not enough information and it should have had more in there. It's important to consider when information sheets are put together and for something like the planning scheme, which is quite complicated, to not try and replicate too much of what is in the scheme because the message gets lost. So in this, if you were to try and regurgitate every element for those people who have actually looked at the LCZ, and try and put it in plain speak, if you like, it starts losing the messages and you run the risk that the interpretation isn't right. So that's why we've had to use the actual documents. We prefer to use the documents that are there because, as you can see, there's often criteria by which you need to meet it. So as an example, the criteria that goes with the qualifications for some of the use tables, if you start typing that out into written word, it gets quite complicated, so it's preferred that the tables be used. And certainly out of the correspondence we've sent back to many people, keeping in mind that the LCZ information sessions captured a certain group of people, but by far there's far more inquiries that come in via phone, counter and emails, and we provide that information. We are happy to take the suggestion that it wasn't made clear enough, and we can certainly make that clearer in future correspondence. It's also worth noting that when we do the formal exhibition of the planning scheme, because this was only one small element, one zone of the 30, so for all the rest of the municipality, there's going to be a lot more information made available and guidance on how to read those documents. But the best approach that I could suggest to people is to really pick up your actual zone that you've got today and then pick up the new one and compare it. It can be difficult to understand how it is you compare those, and we're happy to provide that. We're also hoping to have like a video that helps that, because I'm sure many people here have read reams of written documents. They can be hard to navigate, or they're not very clear. We hope to provide that sort of information to make it clearer and allow the public to understand what the differences are. It's not to sell one zone or another zone. It's simply to be able to equip you to understand what the provisions of the state government has given for us to choose from for the planning scheme.
Last question. Thank you, Mayor. Is it correct or appropriate for council to have previously informed community members that from a practical perspective nothing will really change, and to have described the landscape conservation zone as a misnomer?
Ms. Tullamore.
I disagree that we've said that there's no change, and that there's... I forgot what the second part was.
To clarify, the statement was from a practical perspective.
No, I don't believe that's the messaging. All the zones are going to have an implication. Even if your zone goes from one zone with the same name to the new zone, there is going to be changes in the scheme.
There has been advice coming out from council that from a practical perspective, nothing will really change. Is that not your understanding?
Ms. Tullamore has just indicated that that's not her understanding of the messaging that council has been providing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Would you like to come to the microphone, please? If you could begin by stating your name and suburb in which you live.
So my name is Rob Cooper. I live in Blackmans Bay. My first question is along the same theme of landscape conservation. The fact sheets on landscape conservation recently provided in information sessions appears to focus on the scenarios where development potentially is not negatively affected by the implementation of the landscape conservation zone, and gloss over in planning technical terminology not understood by the wider community, the more likely scenario where development potential will be negatively impacted. Was the intent of the fact sheet to provide unbiased facts equally weighted and explained for all scenarios? And and how would this impact the exhibition and representation process if found to have misled landowners into not lodging representations?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, can you please explain what you believe the negative impacts are so that I can respond?
There are a lot more discretions in the landscape conservation zone. There are a lot of things that are moving from various categories into that discretionary and are permitted but are not the purpose of the zone. A lot of the terminology through it, talking about building envelopes, does not go into explaining what they are, what setbacks are, and the likes. So the first bit, which is very simple, which is the answer is, will the landscape conservation zone remove people's ability to build a dwelling? The first sentence is no, full stop, end of story. And then it goes into a lot of technical planning discussions where it possibly could impact it.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the answer no on that question is no, it's not prohibited. So there was concerns by members of the public that it meant that it was prohibited. It is not. If the table shows clearly that residential is not on the prohibited list, or it's not excluded from the other, so it's therefore not prohibited, you may still need a planning permit to do that, the same as it does for many zones now. So there's not a huge difference in that. The use classes, I'd have to ask you to be specific about which use classes you're specifically referring to in the table, but certainly it's presented in the table, and that was conveyed in the information sessions. As I made the comment before, if we try regurgitating it, all the words from a table into the information sheet, it can get lost and actually be more confusing for people to read. We're happy to consider your comments about that you think that it should go that way, and we can attempt to do that. It may be that we end up having with two different types of information sheets, perhaps, because in a community that has so many people, there are such broad, different perspectives about what is too much, too hard, not enough, expectations of how much detail should be provided in there. It's very hard to be able to target something that is so broad that affects such an enormous community It's not just a part of the community, it's all of the community, to try and satisfy the expectations of too much, not enough, tell us more, tell us less, don't be general, it's too general. So we will take that on board and try and tailor some of that information. I really think that the best thing for people to do if they want to have that discussion or they want to know more is to contact the planning department. And we're a very available planning department. Some councils aren't as available. We are very available to answer questions because sometimes the questions that an individual asks, they are very different to someone else's expectations of what they want to know. They want to know about their house, their property, or what their neighbours are going to do. Other people obviously are more interested in planning principles more generally and have an interest in planning matters more broadly, and we can talk to those as well. But really, it's, as I was saying before, it's hard to tailor it to be specific to a person's particular request, because one person might already have a house and they just want to know whether they can start up a business on that property. Other people have no house at all, bought the property and are nervous that they're not going to be allowed to build a house because they're unfamiliar with what it is. So it's really important that we try and have those conversations, but it's difficult to communicate every single message to everyone without absolutely saturating every scenario. So we can provide scenarios for that. When we did the LCZ sessions, we did do some research about how many people had dwellings. It was interesting. We started off thinking everybody wants to know whether they can build a dwelling or not. But then when we realised that the vast majority of people had a dwelling, we sort of would ask, do you already have a dwelling? Is your interest then that you want to extend your dwelling, build a shed, or potentially subdivide? So it kind of changed it, but it's quite different for different people. I'm not sure if that's answered your question.
I guess the question was there intended bias?
No, there wasn't intended bias.
And then if it is found to have had that bias and misled people, how it would impact the process of representation? I don't want to go through the process of going through representation only to be found that the whole process is deemed invalid due to misleading information.
Through you, Mayor, I absolutely don't believe there's bias. There is nothing for us as officers to gain from this process. There is no reason. We want to make it accessible and easy for people to understand. We've been given the provisions from the state government. We're trying to apply them the best and balance the uniqueness of Kingborough, which does contain some of those environmental elements that some people don't like as much vegetation. Other people think the vegetation is important. We're trying to find that balance through the planning controls, and we're certainly open to hear those through the representations. That's not to say we're not listening before the representations, but that is the process that's been set up for us to go through that. And it's really important that people understand that that is a genuine process, that it's not just lip service from the state government. They really do listen to the representations. There really is the potential for changes to occur, and that's evidenced through the other planning schemes that have already gone through the system.
Thank you for that. My second question is regarding Sherwood Oval and the use of that as a construction stockpiling site. I've been in contact with a number of you a couple of years ago about this and the safety issues for kindergarten children who use that for pick-up and drop-off. There's older kids too, but it's predominantly the kindergarten kids. I stopped engaging on that when a truck driver threatened to thump me a couple of years ago. Recently I've seen that there is kids being dropped off and picked up while heavy machinery is being dropped off in the area, and then the road was resurfaced, which said it was starting at 9 a.m. Early in the week, late last week. And they actually started much before that, so that we had two stop-go entities operating at the same time, the school crossing guard trying to stop traffic while the construction stop-go guy was going. It was chaos, it was mayhem, and there was huge safety issues there. Is council aware of that issue, as I requested the school to report that to council?
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor, yes, we often do use that space for stockpiling materials there, mainly because there's not really any other available spaces in that area, as you'd probably appreciate. The intention is always to have separation between the public and the use of the space, which includes things like hoarding, but it also could include things like operational hours as well as to when they should be operating there. So we certainly aim to operate outside of school pick-up and school drop-off hours, and I certainly would encourage anybody who sees something which is outside of that to contact Council through our customer service number, and we will certainly be chasing that up straight away because that's the information that we provide to our contractors that are actually using that space.
It may be worth investigating what barricading they're using, because the only thing I've seen is a piece of string with little triangles on it, and when you've got school kids that can walk underneath it without touching it, possibly not the best option.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you. Does anybody have any further questions? If you'd like to come to the lectern, just state your name and suburb, please.
Good evening. So my name's Mel O'Keefe and I live at Electrona. My first question today relates to inclusivity. For a number of people in the community, public speaking is a barrier, and certainly I've been speaking to people in recent times who would like to pose questions, who miss the cut-off a week out for the council meeting and are not prepared to come in and speak publicly. I note that the Huon Valley Council provide an option for people to email their question in by 12 o'clock the day prior to the meeting, and that is then read out at the meeting as if the person was there. Is that something that council would do or be prepared to consider so as to provide more opportunities for people to interact with the council?
Thank you. We already have the ability for people to submit questions without notice for each council agenda. Obviously, if we want to be able to provide responses, we need some time for the staff who may or may not be at that particular meeting to be able to prepare a response to put it on notice. It's a system that I believe has worked well up until now, and we do encourage people to email to kc@kingborough.tas.gov.au. But I don't know if the General Manager would like to add anything from an operational perspective. I think you got it, Dad.
Thank you, Mayor. And through you, Mel, we're happy to take on board any suggestion. But as the Mayor alluded to, there are some logistical challenges for us. The process that we've had historically in place has served us well and does provide the officers with sufficient time to do research where it's required. There's always the ability for people to turn up at a council meeting like this and ask questions without notice. And we don't like it when we have to take questions on notice when, with just a little forewarning, we can give it a detailed and considered response. But we'll certainly take it on board.
Yeah, if that could be taken on board, because, as I mentioned, some people are not prepared to speak out publicly. They find public speaking quite intimidating. And whilst we appreciate that, you know, ideally it is nice to have time for people to consider the questions posed, that time isn't provided right here and right now as I speak, and sometimes people don't have that week to submit their question ahead of time. So if that could be considered, that would be great.
If I can just add to the General Manager's answer, I think that given, you know, yes, I totally acknowledge public speaking is not something that everybody enjoys. Some of us are forced to do it. But if people have questions in relation to specifics about whether it be the LCZ or others, then we really encourage them to pick up the phone and talk one-on-one with a member of our planning staff, because that can be often more effective than putting a general question to council staff. If they're seeking a particular information about their own property, or even if they're advocating for, say, a neighbour, if a neighbour doesn't feel comfortable ringing, then we would really encourage that. And as Ms Tyler Moore said, our planning staff have been taking significant time in making themselves available outside of those information sessions that were held, just so that we can get that dialogue going and answer specifics.
Yeah, yeah. But just noting that's not only related to LCZ, and just in the interest of continuing improvement, because as we all know, that because we've always done something a particular way, that doesn't mean that it is perhaps the best way to do it. So moving on to my next question now. With regards to the information sessions recently held, was there any training provided to the staff ahead of the information sessions? And if so, what were the topics and what was the position of the trainer or facilitator?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mev, and no, there was an external trainer's brought in for it. We certainly undertook briefing internally and tried to be as well equipped as we could for the questions that we expected that we were going to get, and that was based on the queries we'd already had from the public. So we were getting a bit of a gist about what people's main considerations were. There was obviously time spent on each of the documents being, I mean, we're all familiar with the existing ones, obviously, but the incoming ones, and being well-rounded on understanding those as well.
Terrific. Thank you.
Do you have a second another question?
I do. Now that the information sessions have been held, is Council going to undertake a survey of those who registered and attended to determine the level of success or otherwise? And if that isn't currently planned, does Council have an appetite to seek feedback to understand how those sessions went?
I'll ask Ms. Tullamore to address that, but it's my understanding that there were staff members present, other than the ones who were doing the consultations on those on the days, who were asking people as they were leaving whether their questions had been answered and so on. But I'll ask Ms. Tullamore to elaborate.
Thank you.
Through you, Mayor, no, there's not an intention to undertake a survey. We've only got limited resources. We'd really like to focus our work more on the work that we're trying to do for the LPS and for all the other parts of the planning scheme, which we need to go back to the TPC with. We're happy to take feedback if people wish to provide it, and I appreciate that some people had, again, it's about this diversity of people in the community, different expectations of what was to be provided. We did our best to communicate that it was really an information session to understand the provisions of the LCZ. It wasn't necessarily to have the debate or different term for that about whether a different zone was more appropriate for them. That's really for the formal consultation process. And as much as we would like to infinitely do the information sessions before, we just don't have the resources. Kingborough Council has only got one strategic planner. Other councils have whole teams of strategic planners. I'm heavily involved in it as well, and my job is far more than LCZ, the planning scheme. It's a whole development services department. So it is limited in what we do, and we're trying to use the resources the best way we can. And that really is investing the time into reviewing the LCZ in light of the comments that have been raised by yourself and by other members of the public about the LCZ. And we've been working on that. The more time we spend on things that could... I mean, I'm not sure what the survey... I don't know what the survey would reveal or what benefit would really be on top instead of actually getting on and doing the work. I completely acknowledge and appreciate there's people that were dead against it, very unhappy about it. Unfortunately, there's always going to be some people that are going to be not going to be able to be turned around on it and have an opinion about that. We face that in local government or in government generally all the time. There's going to be people that have got particular opinions about areas and we're not going to change it. We don't expect it. And we're okay with that. We accept that. We know that not everyone's going to be happy with it. We're doing our best to try and inform what the content is so that you are informed as best as you can to make that decision. We don't take it personally if you don't like the zone that we've done. We've done the best we can and we're happy to consider the changes in that. So I don't see it as a benefit really, but happy if people want to come to us directly about what they think, and certainly would be of interest when we go to do the formal public exhibition period. It's unlikely, I should say now, that it's unlikely we would run the information sessions the same way because we simply do not have the resources. We've got 33,000 residents. We can't service it that way. But not everybody wants it that way as well.
Thank you for your response. I do have responses or feedback from a number of parties, quite alarming in some instances, some of the misinformation that has been put out there. So I think it would be... There is value in seeking feedback. I appreciate that you don't have the resources. And noting that you said that other councils have more than one strategic planner, perhaps that's something that needs to be reviewed in the next budget.
I'm going to take that as a question and let you know that we have actually just advertised for an additional strategic planner.
Fantastic. I'm sure Adrian will be very happy because I know he's a very, very busy man.
Further question?
Yes. So in the new Tasmanian planning scheme for residential development, no permit is required in the residential zone, the inner residential, the low density residential, the rural living village, and even the local business and general business don't require a permit if it's associated with a home-based business. Is Council aware that of all the zones listed, LCZ is the only zone that does not have residential development as no permit required? In fact, it's not even a permitted unless it's on a building envelope, and it's discretionary and therefore at Council's sole discretion.
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I'll answer in part that no, it's not the only zone that has that. I don't have the list before me, so I won't be tricked into saying the wrong ones. So I'm happy to take it on notice and come back with
the answer. Of the ones that I listed, that not saying all the zones, but the ones I listed, I have checked and verified.
I think Ms Tullamore's indicated she'd like to just double-check that before providing commentary, so we can put that on notice.
Terrific. Appreciate that. Thank you. On the fact sheet that Council has issued, it says that that public exhibition of the draft LPS is going to be taking place in April. Is that still likely to be the timeline?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I don't have the information sheet with me. My recollection of the information sheet really wasn't that it wasn't specific about when it would be. It had an estimate that it wouldn't occur before, and we still hold that position. Highly doubt it's going to occur before then. It's up to the TPC to direct us when they're going to do it.
Okay. Now, the Section 8A guideline for zone and code application states that the LCZ is not a replacement zone for environmental living in the planning schemes, that the two have different policy... there are key policy differences between the two zones. The LCZ is not a large residential zone in areas characterised by native vegetation cover and other landscape values. Instead, LCZ provides a clear priority for the protection of landscape values and for complementary uses or development, with residential being largely discretionary. What is Council's rationale for the proposed LCZ for properties that the guideline has expressly said it is not intended for?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the intent really was that it wasn't just a direct one. You wouldn't just swap out one for the other, and that's not what happened. There are obviously many that are going from environmental living to landscape conservation zone. Discussions with the TPC have obviously occurred around that as well, and indications of where it's appropriate and suitable to apply the LCZ. It would be fair to say that the guideline that was written obviously very long time ago, well in excess before they started actually applying the planning schemes. The position that they've taken has changed a little, and that can be seen through the other planning schemes. I think it's important that when we, as you are aware, we are reviewing those and going back to the TPC about the application of that and the methodology, if you like, how that will be applied. And once we have that back from the TPC, it's going to give us the indication of whether they believe the guidelines have been met or not. So it's the TPC's responsibility to make sure that when they're assessing and potentially approving the planning schemes or recommending for approval, that all the guidelines and the criteria have been satisfied. If they weren't, then they wouldn't be signing that off. That's not the indication that we've got from them so far. But I think it would be an important exercise, particularly for the community that's got concerns about the LCZ, that we have a summary report, if you like, as part of the report that explains it, because I can understand the, not confusion, the head scratching.
I'm understanding what you're trying to say.
Well, it kind of says that, so why are you doing that? But it's not as simply applied as that. And I think it's important that we provide that advice in a report type format. But we really need that indication from the TPC. We are bound by the TPC and the rules, and the rules by the state government. And certainly if they said, Kingsbury, you're crazy, you're not allowed to use LCZ where there was EL, well, logically that doesn't make sense. It was always going to be properties that would meet the criteria that would do that. Then we would have to seriously consider. That hasn't occurred to date. But as I said, we'd like to come back with more information.
Yeah, no, because it does seem that there are properties that have been proposed for LCZ that that the guideline specifically says it is not intended for, but appreciate that that's been that there are some reviews underway. And my final... actually, it's not, sorry. Does the council agree that LCZ discourages residential uses?
Ms. Tullamore.
I disagree that it discourages residential uses. It is in the discretionary listing if you don't have a building envelope on your title, so on the sealed plans. For those who aren't aware, that reference is on your title. Some titles have square or rectangle or some shape that's on there that specifies where you should build. There are historic properties that have that. It's more often that we have it for the newer subdivisions where we would actually, where the developer is then required to indicate where that development's going to occur on the property. So that's that sealed plan thing. If you had one of those on there, you would stay in the permitted category. So going forward, you would hope as subdivisions keep occurring that that would be put on there, and it's to find the most suitable site. So to avoid the poor old person who's purchased the property going, well, I can't build it anywhere, but at least it was considered to start with that it was appropriate that there was a building site on that property.
It's interesting that you, the Kingborough Land Use Strategy actually says on page 90, and I quote, that that landscape conservation zone discourages residential use.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I would need to look at that again for better answer. The strategy was written some time ago.
Yeah, May of 2019.
Yeah, and certainly it was before the new scheme was really properly digested, if you can appreciate how long it is. So there will be bits that don't align. It's important to understand that the Land Use Strategy is a guiding document. It's not a statutory document. It's something that was done to complement the regional land use strategy. So Kingborough went a step further of trying to make it more localised relevant to Kingborough, and certainly the overall principles and direction in that I would completely agree with. And, yes, I'm sure there's a number of sentences and lines through that whole document that you're going to find that are potentially contrary.
There are, yes. And my last question, in the fact sheet that Council has put out, it says, once we commence with a formal public exhibition of the draft LPS, there will be a document that explains the reasoning for the zone application within the municipality. As I think we all understand, it's quite a topical matter. Would Council give consideration to releasing that earlier?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, that's, we're still waiting for the approval from TPC to be able to release that, because it'll, there's no point publishing things that the TPC has a fundamental issue with, because it's just confusing for everyone. So, yes, once it's gone through the TPC, then we'll make it available. And, again, we'll be able to provide assistance to people to find the relevant part they are interested in when we go to exhibition.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the public gallery who has a question that they would like to ask? No? If not, thank you very much. We will move on. We're going to questions on notice from the public. We had a number of questions, seven. One was for landscape conservation zoning community sessions from Ms. Price, with a response from Ms. Tyler Moore. Second one also in relation to the landscape conservation zone from Ms. Hanley, and an officer's response from Mr. Stander. On page three, a question in relation to transition to the state planning screen from Ms. O'Keefe, and a response from Dr. Fox. Page four, local provision schedule, a question from Ms. Landon with an officer's response from Mr. Stander. Page five, the toilet block at Christopher Johnson Memorial Park from Mr. Tong, and an officer response from Mr. Reeve. Still on page five, a question in relation to fire bunkers from Professor Michael Rowan, and an officer response from Ms. Tyler Moore. And finally, on page five, an amended answer to previous question on notice from Professor Rowan, and an officer's response from Ms. Everingham. I would remind members of the public that if you do wish to submit a question on notice, you should send it to kc@kingborough.tas.gov.au. Turning now to page nine, questions without notice from councillors. Do any councillors have a question without notice? I've got Councillor Dean and then Councillor Cordova. Councillor Dean.
Yeah, look, I've just got a couple of follow-up questions, actually, on questions. And I do want to start by just acknowledging all the members of the public for coming in and asking the questions, but also to the Manager of Development Services, who's been in the hot seat for almost an hour. But just following up Dr. Evans' questions about what he's referred to as a body of knowledge that planners have been using when assessing DAs against the planning scheme, Is it possible through you, Mayor, that what is actually referring to there are the strategic land use strategies for the manager of development services just referred to? And if possible, could there just be a brief explanation as to how they have informed, where they are still relevant, as you just referred to, given the time overlap of their creation and now that we've got a new statewide planning scheme coming in?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the question that came from the public was, as I understood it and thought was received, was about the assessment under the performance criteria. So when the statutory planners are doing the assessment against the performance criteria, it's not necessarily the regional land use strategies that they go to. The regional land use strategies come up with some overall principles and direction for planning within Tasmania. Are they important? Yes, they are. Are they updated? No, they're not. Are we chasing state government about that? Yes, we are. Are we participating in that review? Yes, we are. And we're keen for it to occur. The body of knowledge for the statutory planners, they all have knowledge of that. The knowledge and the skills to do assessments against performance criteria is different to that, and it comes from overall arching planning principles which are fairly founded across Australia.
And then just to follow up, actually question 10.7, which was from Professor Rowan. It's about ethics training of staff. It does appear in previous meetings a bit of back and forth and time being spent by staff and Professor Rowan on this topic. So trying to get to the crux of actually what's going on here, is it possible that we could potentially just confirm whether if the Integrity Commission is going to be offering some ethics training, whether that's going to be made available, and maybe that might just nip this potentially in the bud?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Thanks for the question, Councillor Dean. Look, the council officer responded to 12 questions from Professor Rowan on the 16th of January. And I suspect that because of the response, there may have been still some scratching of the head. But when we undertake inductions for staff, there are many requirements that we have to address. One of them is the Integrity Commission Act 2009 and Section 32 specifically, which talks about providing education and training on the Act and implementation of the Act. It goes on to talk about code of conduct, etc. In answering the questions on the 16th of January, Professor Rowan asked for a time period of, say, 3 years, which took us back to January 2020. The officer's answer spoke about the sporadic nature of training provided by the Integrity Commission and referenced March and August when training was available biannually. But what wasn't in the answer to the question was that in May of 2020, we were invited by the Integrity Commission to partake in a trial of an online module that had been developed by the Integrity Commission called Training in Ethics for Public Service. We participated in that trial in 2021. The module was launched online. But again, what wasn't covered in the answer to the Professor Rowan's question in January 16th was that when we undertake induction training for council staff, we not only address ethics and integrity, in fact it takes up one third of a 2 hour presentation, but we also address not only the Integrity Commission Act, the Local Government Act, the Anti-Discrimination Act, the Office of the Ombudsman, etc., etc. We've been in discussions with the Integrity Commission and LEGAT and other authorities about how we can actually enhance our induction process. But the bottom line is that the answer to the questions from Professor Rowan on the 16th of January and again in the agenda tonight are similar because the answer on the 16th of January was accurate.
Councillor Dean, follow-up question?
No, just to say thank you, and I appreciate that additional bit of information. I hope that also suits Mr Rowan and that hopefully now...
Thank you. No, so note to the question. Thank you. Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Richardson.
Thank you, Mayor. My question relates to poker machines, electronic gaming machines. On the 1st of November in 2021, Kingborough Council passed a motion that read that Council A acknowledges that pokies cause harm, B has advocated to mitigate that harm by joining the Tasmania Community Coalition in 2016, now referred to as Community Voice on Pokies Reform, alongside other councils. C commits to opposing any additional pokie machines in Kingborough by making a submission wherever a community interest test is being undertaken by an applicant whose proposed licence premises is in our municipality. So my question here is relating to the Mayor's activities in the appendix of this report, specifically 10th of February attended Rest Point Casino for 50th birthday celebrations. And my question is, why was Kingborough Council officially represented at the birthday celebrations for a casino?
I was invited along with a number of other mayors from other municipalities. I'm not sure which ones, but there were a number of other mayors there. I suspect I may have also been invited because I'm the former Minister for Tourism and I accepted the invitation.
Thank you, Mayor. My next question is just, does attending in an official capacity, does that undermine Kingborough Council's participation in the Community Voice on Pokies Reform Coalition? And are we concerned that Kingborough's official attendance at this party undermines our strong anti-pokies message?
No, I'm not.
And was it a good event, a good party?
Well, some people might be critical of my dancing, but apart from that, it was a fine event.
And so my final question, Mayor, is, what is Council doing to reiterate its strong belief that pokies cause harm in our community, acknowledging that the federal group is essentially the monopoly owner of poker machines in pubs and clubs?
Well, I believe when that motion was passed, and somebody, a member of staff might need to refresh my memory, but I believe we did make a submission back in November 2021. I can't recall the specifics of it right now, but, you know, it's not something that we have actively done because we're continuing on with the work of the things that are relevant to our community. When, you know, we certainly did make that statement at the time, and I don't know whether there have been any movements on the state government level where we do get an opportunity to have input as a community or as the local government into any expansion of poker machines in our area. I mean, that's the cause of frustration, as we've had it with other things where the state government in the licensing area doesn't allow us as a council to have a say over, for example, granting a liquor licence to a motorbike gang club rooms, for example. So we've had a lot of frustration with that, and there's that disconnect between state government and local government when it comes to being able to have a formal role to play in those matters that can and do directly affect our community, because it seems that there is a feeling within state government that we shouldn't be able to be at the table to represent our community.
Thank you, Mayor. I really appreciate that detailed answer. And my final question is just to be clear, is it our position that attendance at that 50th anniversary federal group celebration was in no way a tacit endorsement of the federal group's business practice with relation to pokies and their harm?
Absolutely, categorically not.
Thank you.
Councillor Richardson, I had next.
Thank you. And again, I want to echo Councillor Dean's thanks for all the members of the public who have come out today. It's great to see everyone getting involved in the process, and also thank you to the Manager for Development Services for her answers, I guess.
Thank you. Is there a question?
Yes, there is a question.
Excellent.
So, picking up on a couple of comments, the survey of the people who attended these information sessions, I actually think that could be, we could gather some quite valuable information, and for a relatively low cost and fairly easily, if we use an online survey, we have these people's contact details, I would assume. And it doesn't need to be War and Peace, it just has to be a few simple questions on were your questions answered, do you feel more comfortable, those sorts of things. And then that data can be presented back to us, and we can have an objective an objective kind of view of how those sessions worked out, which can give us some good information about these particular sessions, but also feed into how we do these things further, better, different in the future. So the question is there an appetite? Can we look at doing some form of survey?
So I think Ms. Tyler-Moore has already indicated that because, you know, we are struggling with resources in the planning area, that there's a belief that we should be focusing on, you know, responding to individual questions and making staff available at the moment for that sort of thing. As I said earlier, we did have members of staff who were not planning staff who were available as to undertake what I would term an exit survey from members of the community who attended the sessions. I did speak to a couple of those staff members, and they indicated on a whole that the majority of people said that they had received adequate information, that they were, you know, they may not necessarily be happy with what they heard, but that they received, you know, sufficient information. So I don't know whether we need to go any further at this stage, given our resources and where they should be targeted. Now, the information sessions, when we go on public exhibition for that 60-day period, Ms. Tyler-Moore has already indicated, would be significantly different, because we don't have, because it's then across all of the zones and not just at LCZ, we certainly don't have the resources within the planning staff to run them on a one-on-one basis. We thought, given the level of interest in LCZ, we will offer these additional sessions as an opportunity to ask those specific questions. So it's not what is planned for those other ones. We also need to be conscious of the fact that we need to move around the municipality and have sessions on Bruny Island and other parts, so that it's not just centred on Kingston and Margate. Those two areas were chosen because they obviously are there was a level of interest in those areas, and Kingston being with the community hub, and we've got our own facilities there. So certainly at this stage that's not planned, and it's predominantly a resource issue, but you know, I'm happy to open to have a further discussion about it. I don't know if Ms. Tyler-Moore, you'd like to add anything else to that.
Through you, Mayor, no, we are happy to receive the document that Ms. O'Keefe referred to in her question to see it. If it is, we just need to be mindful of the purpose of it. If it's a bit of a witch hunt on staff, then certainly wouldn't want it to go that direction. That's not fair on the staff to be there. If people are dissatisfied with what they have, we're happy to receive those comments. But we want to think of what the most productive and useful resource would be for that.
So it's my understanding that there is a wealth of information available on a Facebook page that comprises of members of the community with concerns about LCZ, where they have provided some feedback. Some of it is not complimentary of staff in a not very respectful way, and as Ms. Tyler-Moore said, that's not something we would want to encourage. If there are constructive suggestions in that body of work, then we're happy to take that on, but I don't want to see this becoming an opportunity to single out individual members of our planning staff and attack their credibility and their integrity, because that is not what this process should be about.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, absolutely agree. I guess my thinking with it is we're getting some subjective responses from staff saying, on the whole, this is what the responses were, and then we're getting some subjective responses from members of the public, and potentially doing a survey, which, you know, I don't know what the cost would be, but I can't imagine it being a huge amount to have an online survey where we can ask the questions, again, asking about the issue, not the people, and actually get that data objectively in black and white as to how people are feeling about that process.
I'm waiting for the question.
How much do we think it might cost?
Ms. Tyler-Moore.
I'm through you, Mayor. It's not the cost of the survey. It's not a dollar. It's the cost of the work that we're doing. So the officers are dealing with trying to provide all the responses to all the cross community. I think it's important not to get stuck on negativity bias. We only hear the negative voices. So yes, there were some negative responses to the LCZ. Yes, there were comments that was a significant amount. There was actually a very large amount that attended. And generally with the negativity bias as well, more about how much outrage that there is about different parts of the zone, which we didn't invent. We're just trying to administer it for the state government. So the cost that we're referring to is all the work that the officers then have to go into. Then all the follow-up that goes with that, the questions that come out of that. We want to service the community fairly for everyone that's asking the questions. If we do the survey, yes, you could. If you just stuck it to it as take the survey, get the answers, do nothing with it, obviously consider what the responses are, we would do that. That's fine. But if it's going to involve more work, more written letters, more written responses, more reports and council meetings and things like that, that's the resource we're talking about, and all the time spent by the officers having to do that, rather than actually getting on, looking at the properties, doing the review of the properties and seeing if this LCZ. We've already conceded that there are properties that are zoned LCZ that probably shouldn't be LCZ, and we're happy to do that. We were never under the impression that was ever going to be the final version that was done back in 2019. And we've given that commitment, and we're doing the genuine process on that. So that resourcing is better directed to get on with it. And I have to apologise to the members of the community that want the new scheme to come in, because we're delaying it. We're delaying getting back to responses because we're getting so tied up on a particular area. And I'm not underplaying what that zone means to particular people. That's fine. It's their property. Change is difficult. Not everyone agrees. Not one, everyone will agree. There's no way that everyone's going to agree to it. We acknowledge that, but we just want to spend the time in there. If you want the survey, do the survey. If the survey comes out that it wasn't good enough, that we were being biased, that we were being misinformation, that's fine, but I'd like it backed up with some actual evidence of what it was and be specific about what it was, not just an attack because there's already an angst around it. So up to the councils, if they want to choose to do the survey, we'll conduct it, we'll host it, but we're not going to spend... Well, you need to decide what you think, what you want to get out of it, and what you're going to do with that information, or do we move on and allow that sort of information and those surveys to be done when we do the public information session.
Councillor Richardson, any further question?
Yeah, just another one, and thank you. One of the concerns that you rightly mention is this talk about bias and whether that does or doesn't exist. I wonder, is there any mechanism in place to identify and mitigate potential explicit bias?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the negativity bias I was referring to different to the bias of staff. Agreed?
Yeah.
Yes. So are staff being biased in the process? Is there a way that's assessed? Yes, that'll be assessed by the TPC. If the TPC sees that we are applying zones in the planning scheme or code overlays that are not appropriate and not in line with what the state government provisions are, then yes, that could potentially get pulled up as a bias. If we decided to make everything one particular way and it was completely biased on that, then that could be seen. As I said it before, there's nothing. Staff have got nothing to gain from it. We're just simply trying to apply the what we can in there. There may be perceived bias, and this has happened at another council, where they just allowed members of the public to choose what the zone was. Is that a bias? Because we're just listening to a personal story rather than applying the planning principles. It's not a road that planning should go down, and I think that that would certainly be considered as bias. I think the question that you're asking, who tests, are we biased staff members, it would be the TPC. Is it being applied properly or not?
Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Richardson. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. My question is, and I have it written up, so forgive me. A person who attended the LCZ information session in Margate messaged me to say that a council officer told them that the public exhibition sessions would likely commence in April. I note well before the June-July rates notice, in which we as council agreed we would use to communicate to any resident affected by zoning change. Through you, Mayor, is that possible that a council officer would say that if we don't even know yet whether the Planning Commission wants us to commence in April, what could possibly be behind that statement, if true?
Thank you. I'll ask Ms. Tullamore to address that because I was not at the session.
No.
Ms. Tullamore.
of course, there was no loading, and that's the advice that we gave the public. It was not likely to occur before April. We're trying to be helpful to explain people the time frame instead of just saying, I don't know, we're waiting for the TPC. That's not helpful. We're trying to give people an idea so when they need to start looking for it. So for the past, the planning scheme's been imminent since I've been here, and I've been here 6 years. that's not through our fault. We gave the draft in 2019 to the TPC, and we didn't hear from them for a number of years, as we know. So we said to people, we doubt that it would occur before 12 months. We doubt it would occur before 6 months. As we're getting close, we're doing that estimate. It's now the start of March. April is around the corner. We doubt it's going to be before April. So we did not say it will occur in April. And the question about the notifications with the rate notices, I have repeatedly said in the council meetings, warned about the timing of that, whether it could be piggybacked on a rates notice or not, and the implications of that. Also that, I mean, the July one, everyone gets it. But if it wasn't that one and it's still not to the next one, not everybody gets the quarterly notice because some people pay their rates up front. So it needs to be consideration. There is a question on notice that was responded to in the agenda about that notification process.
Councillor Antoli,
thank you. My only other follow-up is that we did agree as a council to, and I can understand if you said, sorry, just to close my previous question, I can understand how people could think that if you said it won't happen before, that it might happen after. So sometimes people can definitely get that misunderstanding. I can't speak for the person. I wasn't there either. So if we as a council had agreed that we would notify them of the zoning changes during the rates notice, I actually don't recall any warning from you, unless I'm mistaken, that was not a good idea.
I do recall the discussion because I recall Ms Tyler Moore indicating that it would depend on when the TBC came back to us and when the clock would start and how that would line up. And my recollection of the discussion was that we would look at other mechanisms if that time frame did not align.
Okay, so that's, I think the communication point is probably the important thing. Is if my question was going to be, we can't do it in June, July rates notice, are we going to do it? And so you're saying there is a commitment from you that we will do it somehow.
We need to come up with an alternative mechanism,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, very good. That's good to have that on notice because there are a lot of people that April thing then did cause some concern.
Thank you. Any further questions without notice? If not, we'll move on. Questions on notice from councillors, page 9. At the time the agenda was compiled, there were no questions on notice from councillors. Open session of council now adjourns at 6:41 p.m. and the planning authority commences at 6:41 p.m. We're now on page 10, officers' reports to the planning authority. We are on DA 321 of 2022, development application for a property at 31 New Bina Crescent and 41 New Bina Crescent and adjoining the waters of the River Derwent in Taroona, with a recommendation on page 35. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved, Councillor Gladright. Seconded, Councillor Bain. Thank you. And I'll just note for the purpose of the tape that Councillor Cordova has left the room at 6:42 p.m. as he had declared an interest in this matter. Councillor Gladright.
Thank you, Mayor. So this development application is proposing a partial demolition, alterations and addition for tertiary education and research and development and associated infrastructure works. The recommendation is approval with conditions. I note there were 11 representations. A couple of things that I'd like to highlight. The application is supported by an acoustic assessment. Sorry, Mayor.
Oh, I beg your pardon, sorry. Before you continue, there is an amended condition. Is that going to go up on the screen? Ms Tullamore, did you want to...
Through you, Mayor. Deputy Mayor Clayright. It's just obviously tired from my last lot of questions. There are two amended conditions that have been recommended. One is condition 13, I believe. Check. These were circulated to the councillors. Condition 13 is not the one.
No.
Sorry.
Oh, go back up. 24. 23.
Condition 23 is amended, recommended for amendment. It was to do with a power failure on the original permit. It was just around the wording and the requirement for that to say whether there has been a mains power or mechanical plant failure, and also the addition of condition 27, which relates to the Tasmanian Heritage Council, which is set out in Appendix B and has been circulated to all councillors. It just makes reference to some of the landscaping requirements around the house. It doesn't specifically change the house or have an impact on the cottage, as it's generally called about. So it's recommended both those conditions, one be amended, one be added, for the determination tonight.
Thank you. Councillor Gladright, if you'd like to continue.
Thank you. Just to note that I have received communication from the Taruna Community Association, and they've voiced concerns about the state of the road and the impact of the increase in traffic. I can see that those have been dealt with in the report, and get me back on track if I'm steering away from where I'm allowed to here, but I think it would be good if we could consider some type of traffic calming measures, but I understand that has to be dealt with outside of the planning authority. So I just wanted to state that I've heard those concerns, and it would be great if we could note those. So I'm happy to support the recommendation.
Thank you, Councillor Gladright. Any further speakers? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. This is a question just understanding process. This is definitely not in any way, shape or form intended to be a criticism. So there have been these last minute two amendment changes to the application. The one about the heritage listing, can someone explain to me why this was inserted in at the last minute? I would have thought something like this would have been a little bit more known beforehand.
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the applicant had provided a heritage report with their application, which was obviously considered. As it says in the report, it doesn't come under the Tasmanian, under the Kingborough Planning Scheme listing, the Tasmanian Heritage one. The applicant had provided copies of certificates of exemption, because you can get certificates of exemption from the Tasmanian Heritage Office, but it became apparent that they weren't actually for the works that they had proposed. The documentation that comes back has limited information in it that we get back from the TPC. So it was conversations with the Tasmanian Heritage Council that, in fact, it wasn't, and the Tasmanian Heritage Council did review the application and provided that response, which is included in Condition 27.
Thank you. That was very helpful. If I may ask a follow-up, please, Mayor.
Thank you.
You've mentioned that you've communicated this to the applicant, which is fantastic, and there doesn't appear to be any adverse responses, so I can assume this last-minute change doesn't seem to add any amount of a restriction on what they're planning to achieve.
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, it's important to consider two elements in this. One was, does it affect the applicant? That's not to say that we only put conditions on that applicants are satisfied with. We do it as it is appropriate and as we're required under the Act, but we have spoken to the applicant and they've got no opposition to it. And the other element that you must consider is, does it have an imposition on the representors? If there was a condition in there that's going to make it perceived worse or more material detriment to them, that's important. We considered the changes that came up as a result, which came up later, and unfortunately the representatives, who I believe some are here tonight, wouldn't have been aware of that change to the conditions, but we see it as not really affecting the concerns that they have. It doesn't resolve the concerns they may have, but it's not. It hasn't created a worse situation.
Thank you.
Next I had Councillor Fox and then Councillor Dean. Councillor Fox.
Thank you. On page 34 I note that comments made about the amount of glass in this building have been addressed by providing low reflectivity glazing and on recommended elevations, and also include a notation that they provide a screen which needs to be fixed to be an acceptable solution. I'm really pleased about that because of the amount of blue gums in the area, and a lot of trees are being removed. So the habitat for these the parrots in this area is being constricted considerably, and any loss of further birds would be terrible. And I need to point out that this is a planning decision, and it's based on the planning scheme and how they comply and conditions. It's not a matter of whether we like or dislike this development, and I know that there's a lot of angst in the Taroona community, especially about the loss of vegetation that this is going to cause. But the planning scheme being as it is, I think the document that's been provided covers the issues that are of concern mostly, except for the loss of trees, and I'm going to support the recommendation. Thank you.
Councillor Fox. Next I had Councillor Dean.
Pages 21 to 23 of the agenda detail the constraints of the site, and there was a bit of back and forth that it details between council and the applicant about finding the most optimal building site. The applicant clearly had some functional requirements, and there was always going to be some kind of impact on the local environment, I understand that. And this is probably, I guess, the eternal question around development, I guess, but could, through you, Mayor, perhaps give an indication about the balance that was achieved in this example between, I guess, the functional requirement of the application and the environmental impact?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, that's a big question. I wasn't part of the specific conversations about the design changes, and I haven't come prepared to the meeting to tell you all the changes that occurred in there. Certainly, you weren't on council at the time, but prior to this there was a development approved for this site for the lobster hatchery, which didn't go ahead. It sits on the same site, but we do acknowledge that this is a much larger development and larger in its sense of its purpose as well. The elements that need to be considered in deciding is trying to limit the impact on the adjoining residential areas and residential properties, the impacts on the heritage listed property, and the environmental impact, which includes the trees. Again, it comes back to this thing that occurs, that some people complain we allow too many trees to go, then yet the other half of the camp is saying we are too strict and we try and keep too many trees. We do our best to try and keep the balance. There are conditions in there about offsetting the environmental values with respect to trees on that property and beyond, and certainly there's other requirements for developments within that precinct that UTAS needs to comply with in development and subdivisions that have occurred on that site.
Councillor Dean.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate the author of the report. I guess I'm trying to put on the record potentially, I guess, the back and forth between the applicant and us, and to see whether the building site was ending up just what they had said, be it or leave it kind of approach, or whether there was some mutual negotiation between balancing the environmental impact. Because I note in the report it says things like submissions, we requested further information, but doesn't quite name up exactly, you know, was there a negotiation that went ahead, or was it really just we're doing this and that's it?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the UTAS had taken a good approach by coming to a pre-application meetings with us, whereby we sat down and looked at some of the proposal and the intentions of the site. So I would say that there were negotiations around what was suitable for the site, and noting those limitations that I mentioned before and the other functions of the site. Again, it comes back to that half the camp says that we're too fussy, we try changing too many things, the other half of the camp say we accept everything. But certainly there were changes that occurred as part of this development, and UTAS has, not that I don't want to sound like we're being biased, has come to the party with the reports that they needed to do and evidence that of what the impacts were on those properties, and considered the impacts on the community. UTAS did go outside their communication requirements in terms of the statutory system, but which is up to them what they do for their own public relations, but that's not a relevant matter to be considered by the planning authority tonight, whether they're the good or the bad in terms of communications and the like. It must be assessed on the merits of the planning scheme.
Councillor Dean.
My next couple of questions just relate to traffic. I want to talk about that in my contribution, but just want to relate, I guess, a few questions that I've had from the community of late. As we see on figure 3 on page 14, at the building site borders on at the very bottom lot 1, and you can see that Taruna Crescent and the car park that accesses Taruna Beach is down there. So what some residents are asking me, and I haven't given the full explanation, to be honest, is why there wasn't considered, given the traffic impact is solely with Newbean, and given that there's access to a, be it small, boat ramp, why there wasn't the capacity to provide two access points for traffic as part of the development application.
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor. So Lot 1 doesn't form part of the development. Lot 1's actually going to be transferred to Council. That was from a previous subdivision that occurred. Consideration was given to whether there it would be useful to divert the traffic onto a different route. But on balance of the other competing needs, if you like, such as the vegetation, and the benefits of doing that, it wasn't seen to outweigh what would occur in Newbina Crescent. So there didn't seem there wasn't seen a real benefit, and obviously there was no right to necessarily be allowed to cross those other sites. It does complicate it somewhat, but it definitely was discussed.
Councillor Dean.
And my last question is also around Newbina Crescent, and I appreciate there was a traffic impact assessment done, and that we've endorsed this, or our staff have endorsed this. So, again, questions from the community really relate to Newbina Crescent, and I'll talk to that in a minute, but could it be perhaps be explained why we can't just mandate the applicant to, you know, contribute to the upgrading of, say, Newbina Crescent further away from the actual access site?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, there are instances where you can require modification to road networks where it's creating a significant change or impost on that road and it's not suitable. So that does occur with planning applications from time to time where where it might be an unsealed road and they're required to seal it, or they might be required to widen it. There's been applications such as the former Vodafone site where they have to do traffic calming devices at certain points as that school gets bigger. In this particular instance, there wasn't enough evidence to suggest that it was going to cause it to that extent. It's important to note that many of the concerns about Newbina Crescent are to do with existing problems, and that's where the comment comes, that Council needs to look at it as Council, not as the planning authority, whether they need to resolve that. So just because there's existing problems and new development comes doesn't mean it's their responsibility to fix it. If they're making it substantially worse or going to put so much more traffic on there, they are going to put more traffic on there, that's not denied, then there would be a better nexus to require modifications of that road.
Any further discussions? Councillor Dean.
If no one else would make a contribution or questions, then I'll
go for it.
Have my few minutes. Look, obviously someone who grew up in Taruna and only lives a few minutes away from this place, as Councillor Fox has pointed out, that's received a lot of interest locally, and there's a lot of people in Taruna listening to this tonight, so I think it warrants a little bit more of a comment from us. Look, there's some strongly held views, and I think the fact there was 11 representations, as the Deputy Mayor has pointed out, gives some kind of indication. But I also did want to just acknowledge that there are some positive attitudes and make that clear to the applicant and to those around here, that there is some positive views about the IMS expansion. There's support for the research that's going to undertake. There's support for the benefits that this will bring globally for the environment. There's support for the localised benefits it will bring from increased business that's generated from welcoming more staff and undergraduate students to the community for the first time, or from the fact that there will be a more serviceable car park in the area. So there are concerns, clearly, but I think it's noted also in the representations that there are some positives. Ultimately, though, I want to talk a little bit about process. Because as Councillor Fox has pointed out, we can't assess this on whether the community wants it ultimately or not. It's about the planning scheme and what we deem fit or we feel comfortable with the officer's recommendation. And I have sat down with the planning staff to look at this in depth, and I've read this report obviously and considered it really carefully, and I think ultimately I am comfortable with the recommendation for approval. But I think it's worthy to talk a little bit to the process here around a planning scheme. So what I want to focus on my contribution on is about pages 26 and 27 that refer to the traffic impact assessment. So within the parameters of that assessment, and that we are sitting here as a planning authority, I note that the following section on report on page 29, the comment is that the provisions of the planning scheme only, quote, require that the access into the site from the road and the internal car parking and manoeuvring comply with the relevant engineering standards. So when the traffic impact assessment was done, this criteria for existing roads and accesses and junctions was deemed acceptable. The acceptable solution, A3 on page 26, highlights that vehicle movements must not increase by 20% or more than 40 vehicles a day. And the impact assessment highlights that, on average, Nubina has 300 vehicles using it per day, and that the estimate from that impact assessment that it will increase by 62. So while the increase is deemed more than the acceptable solution, and we consider this in the recent five-year crash history, I do get that how it was deemed as acceptable. But ultimately, I think there's some considerations that we as councillors should be aware of moving forward in terms of the process here, but also with respect to Nubina Crescent, which the Deputy Mayor has alluded to. And I think it needs to go beyond, in terms of our process, beyond car counting and crash statistics, to be honest. So as it gets commented on representation 2.51, Nubina was originally built as a quiet residential street, but that its use has intensified due to the university and the soccer club. It's important to add here that the university and soccer club aren't the only reason that traffic's increased. Nubina Crescent also serves as the community hall, the Possums Play Centre, the Bowls and Community Club, the Taruna Fire Station, the Taruna Tennis Club, the skate park, the dog walking section of Nubina Reserve, and the local community garden. So I'm pointing this out because a significant amount of the traffic that these organisations generate isn't actually from cars, but from pedestrians. Yet, unfortunately, pedestrian use is not something that is actually considered in the traffic impact assessment. Instead, only pedestrian use generated by the DA is considered. And I find that somewhat problematic. So again, within the parameters of the planning scheme, I understand why it's our view that the access to the road is sufficient. But ultimately, as I've pointed out, there's a lot that hasn't been measured. And what this ultimately adds up to is the feeling or perception amongst locals that this road is not fit for purpose and is not safe, as safe as it should be. And I agree, I'm far more careful when walking this street with my toddler than I am in any other side street in Taruna. And a key reason for this is due to the speeds that cars travel down when coming down Nubina. So again, when measuring down at the site, the 85th percentile speed, as is in the report, was estimated around 30 kilometres an hour. And that's fine. That's really good. This is a good number because it's clearly well below the speed limit. It's unsurprising, though, given it's a dead end and the site that we're discussing here is right at the end of that dead end. However, speed counts done by council further up the road, which is where residents have their concerns, have an 85th percentile speed of 42.5 kilometres per hour. So on paper, again, this sounds good, but it's under the 50 kilometre speed limit. However, if the road was reduced to 40 kilometres per hour, which is what some locals feel is appropriate for the site or area, then there would be, in fact, 85% of road users speeding. This, I hope, helps paint the picture of why this perception exists amongst locals. But this is a perception that hasn't come out. Seek extension of 2 minutes.
2 minutes. The motion is that Councillor Dean be granted a two-minute extension, moved by Councillor Antoli, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. Councillor Dean, you have 2 more minutes.
I very much appreciate that. But this perception hasn't come about just because of IMAS, and it's not the applicant's fault that there are so many other organisations that use this road. There is a feeling, though, that this DA is only going to make a bad situation worse. Council itself has already attempted to put in traffic calming measures and line-of-sight improvements on this road. For example, they've installed lane markers at the junction with Chilton Chase, about 100 metres up from the access to IMAS. These, I'm sure, were intended to keep drivers on the correct side of the road, but they're insufficient as people don't fully slow down and they actually end up driving on the wrong side of the road. I do appreciate these safety measures aren't only caused by the applicant, and I also appreciate that we are limited in our capacity to mandate surrounding infrastructure be upgraded, just as the Development Manager Services has spoken about. But what I hope I've done is made it clear to council why, to the council and the applicant, as to why we need to take these concerns seriously. I'm grateful that council staff have already met with me on site and have agreed to undertake some pedestrian counts in the area. And so while I will be, obviously, thank you for the extra time, be supporting the this DA, I do think there's an opportunity in the months ahead for there to be a serious discussion between residents, council and the applicant as to how we might be able to ensure this road is kept safe for all people that use it.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. I think you slightly veered outside of the parameters of what we're meant to discuss as a planning authority, but I've allowed you that latitude because I could see your determination to get that out. But are there any further speakers on this? Before I ask Councillor Gladright to sum up, I just wanted to acknowledge the representations that we have received in relation to this. There was obviously a lot of thought that went into those and the passion from the Taruna community, as evidenced by Councillor Dean's contribution. And I appreciate that for many of you that this is frustrating, and it can be frustrating as a council when we are constrained in what we can say, but also that we have to assess everything that comes before us as a planning authority based on the merits of the planning scheme and how a submission stacks up against it. And it is a strange system, if you like. It's one where we're almost constrained to represent our community and the opinions of our community, and Councillor Fox articulated that earlier. So I do sincerely thank those members who have taken the time to write in to express their concern about this. And I would like to ask Councillor Gladright to sum up, please.
Thank you, Mayor. Yes, thank you, Councillor Dean. I completely echo your sentiments about Nubina Crescent. Unfortunately, we can't deal with that issue tonight under the Planning Authority, but as Chair of the Safety Committee meeting, I'd be happy to invite you along to express your concerns on behalf of your community.
I'm going to put the recommendation now. It is as printed on page 35 of the agenda. It was moved by Councillor Gladright and seconded by Councillor Bain. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. The Planning Authority of Council now adjourns at 7:06 p.m. We'll ask Councillor Cordova, if somebody could let Councillor Cordova know. Councillor Cordova has returned to the room at 7:06 p.m. I might just call a short recess, and we'll try and be back by 7:15, please. A very short recess. Thank you very much. For those watching at home, we're just taking a short comfort break and we'll be back at 7:15. Thank you. Okay. 7:15. Okay, we're on. Welcome back. Thank you very much for everybody returning. The open session of Council recommences at 7:13 p.m. Thank you very much. We're now on page 90, petitions still being actioned. There are no petitions still being actioned, and at the time the agenda was compiled, there were no petitions that had been received. Turning now to officers' reports to Council. Copping Refuse Site Joint Disposal Authority proposed rule changes with a recommendation on page 92. I'm looking for a mover. I have one in Councillor Street and a seconder in Councillor Gladright. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. I move the recommended motion. Just point out, as I was just waxing lyrical to Councillor Richardson a moment ago, that this is now the third time that these changes have been before Council for one reason or another. They are eminently sensible changes to the constitution of the Copping Refuse Site Joint Disposal Authority. It's a good thing that we're going through some Local Government Act review changes at the moment, review and potential changes to the Act at the moment, because this is probably one area that could really do with some change, given that, yeah, like I said, this is now the third time that we've been asked to agree to these changes. A cursory glance of them shows that they are all in line with good governance principles that would be expected of any independent body corporate, and I wholeheartedly recommend the motion to my colleagues.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Any further discussion? Councillor Dean.
I did actually read all of these. And
you have a small child. It's remarkable.
And no, they, just like Councillor Street said, they all seem really sensible. Just the one question, potentially the General Manager or through you, Mayor, could answer this one. I note that they're looking at paying, I guess, the Chair, but not really referencing, you know, how much. Out of interest, what kind of figures are we talking here, and when? Where would that, I guess it obviously comes out of there, but how much were we talking there?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, they haven't got a figure in mind at this stage, Councillor Dean, except to say that, again, in keeping with good governance, to have an independent body and an independent chair, you need to pay accordingly to get the skills that the board need.
Any further questions? If not, I will put the motion. Councillor Street, do you want to sum up?
Oh, just I look forward to them coming back for the fourth time, which
excellent.
Will be required before
they're
adopted.
I'll be expecting you to move it on that occasion. So it's moved, Councillor Street, seconded Councillor Gladright, that Kimbra Council approves the proposed amendments to the rules of the Copping Refuse Site Joint Disposal Authority. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried. We move now to page 100, Legat General Management Committee vacancy, with a recommendation on page 101, looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Gladright, seconder in Councillor Dean. Councillor Gladright.
Thank you, Mayor. The purpose of this report is to enable Council to consider the nomination of a councillor for the position of President of the Local Government Association of Tasmania and or the position of Committee Member of the General Management Committee. I would like to nominate Mayor Reet, please, for the position of Committee Member of the General Management Committee, noting that nominations must be received by the 19th of April.
Thank you, Councillor Gladright. I accept your nomination. Are there any further nominations or discussion? Councillor Dean.
I fully endorse that, and it unfortunately means I can't nominate Councillor Bain, so well done, Councillor Reet.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. So nominating for the Chair is different to nominating for a committee position, is that correct?
Yes, so the President of Legat, yes, is different from the General Management Committee. So the General, the President of Legat is retiring at the, later in the year, November, mid-year. June. There would be generally, you can expect about half a dozen people from around the state. Normally mayors would nominate for that position, and then the General Management Committee comprises of a number of representatives of councils according to the all the different sizes of councils are represented, and they meet on a monthly basis, I believe. The President is involved in those meetings, but it's the President then primarily who does media on behalf of Legat, liaises with directly with the Minister, etc.
Is the Chair a full-time position, is it, or it's a part-time role?
It's a part-time role because the Chair is still also the Mayor of their council.
I'm surprised you would nominate. I think you do a great job at it.
Thank you very much. I believe there are... what the process is that the there will be a number of people who would nominate, and then councils are asked to then make a decision as to which candidate each council would support and vote for, and that's how that person is then elected in. Without naming anyone, I'm already aware of three mayors in the south of the state who are intending to nominate. At some point a further paper would come back to council where we would look at the nominees and have a collective position on who we should support.
Well, I do feel like having someone from Kingborough on the committee is a great idea and worthy of our vote, in my opinion.
Thank you. I don't think we've had a GMC rep for quite a while, actually, so it would be good if we could get somebody on there, and I'd be happy to fulfil that role. Any further discussion? Councillor Gladright, do you want to sum up? Okay. I will put the motion now that Council nominate... feels weird. Council nominate the Mayor, Councillor Reet, for the position of Committee Member on the Local Government Association of Tasmania's General Management Committee. Moved by Councillor Gladright, seconded by Councillor Dean. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Thank you very much. We turn now to notices of motion, page 102. Councillor Cordova submitted a notice of motion headed Environmental and Planning Control Offenders Register with a response from Dr. Fox. Councillor Cordova, you'd like to move the motion. Do I have a seconder? If there's no seconder, the motion lapses. No. No.
I'll second.
Thank you.
And it's seconded by Councillor Glaidwright. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you very much. And might I start by really thanking the Deputy Mayor for giving us the chance to at least have this discussion. I really do appreciate that. Even if you don't support these things, it's really great to have that discussion. So I appreciate it. Look, what we're looking at here is something that already exists in various jurisdictions like Canada. And the idea is basically that when people deliberately flout the law, and they do it as a cost of doing business, we want some mechanism, or I want some mechanism, to be able to constrain or slow down their ability to profit off their malfeasance. So this is an Environmental and Planning Control Offenders Register that would essentially, in a way, name and shame people who deliberately violate our environmental and planning control laws so that we could find some constraints on their ability to simply do whatever they like, flout the law and then make profit off the very same land that they have flouted the law on. This would go some way to meeting community expectations of accountability. It would go some way to improving the public transparency around those guilty parties who have, I think, around this state and many other states around the country, simply factored in the cost of fees and fines associated with breaking the rules. They've simply factored that in as a cost of doing business. So the example I use here is that in most cases, unless things go to court, the maximum penalty that somebody can pay for even the most egregious of offences is somewhere around $2,715. And I think that goes no way to meeting community expectations about you know, the severity of these infringements. So we can do some things, as is noted in the officer's report, things like putting up signs that say, you know, who vandalised our tree, if somebody takes down a tree. I feel like those kinds of signs essentially disrupt innocent neighbours, and it's kind of, unfortunately, a misguided collective punishment where innocent neighbours have to look at these signs, and I haven't seen any evidence yet that they actually go any way to changing the behaviour of those guilty parties. So the people that we're talking about here would be those who have been found guilty where the Kimberley Council has jurisdiction, those people who have been issued infringement notices. And as I importantly, in the last paragraph of my motion, it says the report may recommend parameters, exemptions, options for delegated authority and relevant definitions, for example, that the register only applies to infringements that may meet some threshold. And I think this directly answers the officer's response where it says, at one of the final dot points, for example, publishing the names of, quote, mum and dad developers for mistakes made while undertaking residential extensions would be highly undesirable. And I just want to raise the point that much like this vague term, the middle class, you know, if you ask somebody if they think they're middle class, most people think that they're middle class, whether they're a surgeon on $500,000 or whether they're somebody on a very low income. The same thing is true for this elusive idea of mum and dad developers. What is a mum and dad developer? Is it somebody with no kids and this is their first development application, or is it somebody who has kids but has $100 million? What is this elusive mum and dad developer who we always try so hard to defend? What about somebody with kids but they've never before put in a development application but they have $100 million and they're building a five-story building? Are they a mum and dad investor? What if it's their first five-story building that they're building? Are they a mum and dad developer? I think when we use these vague terms, we're trying to paint a picture about something very elusive and abstract. And we're doing that at the expense, I think, of the renters and the people in the community who actually deserve to have their rights not infringed upon by people who flagrantly flout the rules and are seemingly getting away with it because they're only paying these measly fines. So I think that the rights of community members, whether they've got kids or not, should be more important than the rights of whatever this so-called mum and dad developer is. But that's why, indeed, I say in the motion that this report would actually set those parameters. So if we say the certain threshold should be a development application that is whatever size or whatever cost or whatever, you know, we could set a threshold. And so that's what I'm suggesting we do. Fundamentally, this idea has worked elsewhere, and it would set a real disincentive for people to actually break the law, knowing that all they have to do is pay a measly fine and then they'll profit many, many fold larger simply by paying the fine as a cost of doing business. So I think this is something tangible that we can do as a council. We can set those expectations that people who are trying to develop in this municipality should not do it at the expense of the law, and they shouldn't do it at the expense of their communities. I think it's a fairly straightforward register. I know that we could do it, and I implore my colleagues to meet the community expectation by passing this motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Street and then Councillor Gladright. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, it's my intention to keep my remarks relatively short, as I think that Dr. Fox's officer's response is a pretty concise assessment of why this is a bad idea. The objectives of the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act, as Dr. Fox rightly points out, are about promoting sustainable development of natural and physical resources and the maintenance of ecological processes and genetic diversity, facilitating economic development, amongst other things. The Act is not about the naming and shaming of those who might infringe upon it. We have a statutory obligation to enforce the LUPA, of course, and identify potential breaches, but that's our only role under that Act. We don't have the capacity to consider whether to name and shame those who infringe against it. We're not vested in any sense with the judicial power necessary to identify who should be on that list and who should not be on that list, nor should we be. We're not a court. We're not even a quasi-judicial body. We don't have the ability to make those determinations, and we shouldn't be asked to. Dr. Fox goes on to make a number of other extremely reasonable points in relation to this, including privacy issues associated with publishing names and property addresses of offenders, and the issues with determining a threshold for serious environmental or planning control violation. And Councillor Cordova's disingenuous. I mean, he understands what
point
we're
of
talking
order.
About when we...
Mischaracterisation, yes, point of order. That's offensive to me, and I find it offensive. Please withdraw it.
Councillor Cordova, on a point of order, I didn't even get to say that. Councillor Cordova has asked you to withdraw the phrase that he is being disingenuous because he is offended by it. Councillor Street?
Look, I'll withdraw it.
Thank you, Councillor
well
Street.
To listen
you can
to the
continue.
Next part of the sentence, though. And what I was going to go on to say is that I think Councillor Cordova really does understand what we're talking about when we talk about mum and dad developers. We're talking about the person who's not familiar necessarily with planning controls and the planning scheme and LUPA, which is an incredibly complex system by any measure, and who makes a mistake. It happens. And I'm not to suggest for a second that that person should be named and shamed publicly is ridiculous. I also have to say I find it interesting, Mayor, that a councillor who has sat around this table and railed against the idea that there would be further police in Kingborough because it would focus on offenders and crime rather than the causes of offending and crime would put up a motion like this, profess to be a proponent of therapeutic jurisprudence in this very chamber, and then come and said that the way that we should deal with these matters is by publicly naming and shaming those who offend against the LUPA. That is cognitive dissonance in its extreme, in my view. So there are a number of good reasons in the report why this is a bad idea. I urge anybody listening to read those before taking Councillor Cordova's contribution as gospel, and I will be voting against the motion.
Thank you, Councillor Street, Councillor Gladright, and then Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. Councillor Cordova, I really empathise with the sentiment that you were describing in this motion. However, because there are several legal issues and there's no supporting legislation to enable this, I can't support it.
Thank you, Councillor Gladright. Councillor Dean.
Just a question. The supporting statement, and Councillor Cordova has already referred to Canada as being a jurisdiction where there is an environmental offenders register. I did a quick look and it appears just to be for corporations only rather than the individual. So I'm just wondering, is there another council through you, Mayor, or through staff potentially in Australia of a council where this already exists that might help us kind of flesh out some of the issues that the officer has raised in the response?
My understanding is there isn't, but Dr. Fox, could you assist us?
Well, look, I do. Thank you for the question. And
you might need to remove your face mask because we can't hear you.
Thank you for the question and through you, Mayor. I am not an expert in this space and I'm certainly not Council's legal advisor, but I did do a bit of a search around looking for what I could find in Australia. As Councillor Cordova has mentioned, there are systems in Canada and in Western Australia there is a system around naming offenders food businesses that are offenders in legislation over there. In each of the examples that I could find, and I couldn't find any local government in Australia, all of those registers were backed up by supporting legislation which enabled those listings to happen. As I said, if it is the will of Council, I can do further investigation, but my preliminary investigation didn't reveal anything in Australia.
Thank you, Dr. Fox. Councillor Dean.
Yeah, no, thank you. And like Councillor Gladright, I do support the sentiment behind the motion. I think we're probably all familiar, especially recently, of examples where land has potentially been illegally cleared as a cost of doing business, and it's not just here in this region, but elsewhere. But like I see the problem Councillor Cordova is trying to fix, but looking in the officer's report, I just think the concept has far too many issues for me to be confident that we should be taking up more of staff or officers' time developing a more detailed response. Instead, like Councillor Street has pointed out, it's probably something that needs to come from the state and adjustment to LUPA, as obviously we don't have that capacity, as pointed out in the by Councillor Street and in the response. So I can't support it, unfortunately, at this stage.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. I also agree with, I think, what this motion is trying to achieve, and that's to, I guess, penalise the people who are deliberately flaunting the system. But as has already been said, the officer's response has a lot of dot points in there why it shouldn't be done. And apart from the one that talks about potentially writing to suggest an increase of the fees, I think there's lots of reasons there not to support the motion, and that's what I'll be doing.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Further discussion? Councillor Fox.
Just to point out, I think on page 103, the point hasn't been raised that when staff are aware of breaches, they work very hard to seek and work out resolutions to the problem and rectify them. And they look for amendments to the development, rehabilitation and seeking retrospective approval. And retrospective approval generally is twice the amount of the actual planning fee. So in answer to Councillor Bain's comment, there is actually a penalty associated with it, but that is just a financial penalty and it's usually... It's all about arbitration and trying to find a middle ground. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Just before I ask Councillor Cordova to sum up, I just wanted to make a brief contribution. Look, I appreciate Councillor Cordova bringing the matter before us, but I do feel that it hasn't quite hit the mark because I appreciate the advice of the staff that we don't have the legal capacity to do this. There is no precedent in... certainly not in Tasmania under LUPA for this. Whilst we do, as Councillor Fox said, if somebody has put in a development application and they haven't... if they haven't put in a DA and they're found then to have infringed that, they have to put in a retrospective one and it is twice the fee. So I guess it's not... it's not a substantial penalty for them. But I get very nervous when we start to talk about privacy issues, about publishing names and addresses, particularly of individuals. There are, as has been identified by the state government recently in relation to the Department of Justice, a monetary penalties register that has significant implications for publishing the names of individuals, particularly if they are people who have been escaping domestic violence situations where their information is publicly available. So we would need someone, which is not us because we don't have the power, within the state government to consider something like this that would be across government and would take those sorts of things into consideration. Now, I think it's highly unlikely, given they've just withdrawn their monetary penalties register or are going to do that, that they would consider it. But I would suggest that if Councillor Cordova feels, you know, continues to feel passionate about this, that perhaps a more appropriate thing would be to bring a notice of motion where we can lobby the state government, either directly or via Legat, to ask them to address this problem that we're finding ourselves in, because of course, as we are all very much aware, we are not able to consider the previous offences or infringements of applicants when we are considering a development application. That is a fundamental problem in Looper. And you know, I think there are this is far more complex than just simply deciding to develop a register and provide details and provide them for 10 years. And, you know, I think the state government would have a significant role to play in how it could be developed and make it a statewide approach. I don't think it would be particularly useful to have it just as one municipality doing it. I think it would need to be every council doing it. But what form that would take, I'm not sure, and I think there'd be quite a bit more work to be done. But unfortunately, there is not the power for us to do this, and I would not want to see any unintended consequences. I certainly would like to see increases in the penalty units applied under Looper. I think that all of us here would likely agree that you can do something quite destructive and get the maximum penalty of around $2,700, which is really insufficient in many cases of something that cannot be undone in a simple way. So I think that's probably where we need to focus our immediate energy. So thank you, Councillor Cordova, for bringing this up. I think it's a valuable debate to have had, and I'd ask you if you'd like to close it.
Can I ask a question, Mayor?
No, you
thank
can't.
You. So, I think.
Oh, sorry, you can.
Thank you.
Your pardon, because you haven't closed it yet.
Thank you
your pardon.
So much.
Yes, you can.
My question is, why does it have to be done under Looper with fees and charges? I thought we had our own, as a council, our own jurisdiction over that. So, why would this register have to be administered under the provisions of Looper? Why couldn't it just be a motion of council?
Dr. Fox.
So as I understand it, and feel free to jump in further along the bench if you like, as I understand it, the penalties are set for offences under Looper within the Act. So if a person offends under that legislation, it says this many penalty units will be applied. We could certainly change our fees and charges as a council, that we do set up through our fees and charges schedule each year, for things like assessments and applications and retrospective applications, but not for those offences defined under legislation.
Thank you. Happy to sum up now.
Councillor Cordova, on the summation.
Thank you, Mayor. And I found this conversation edifying, so I'm really pleased that the motion didn't lapse for want of a seconder. So once again, thank you to the Deputy Mayor, because it was worth having this conversation. There is a community appetite out there, because there is a general recognition around this state and around this country that developers who have a lot of capital at their disposal are easily able to accommodate a $2,700 fee. And when you stand to make $1 million or $10 million off a development, paying a $2,000 fee for breaking the law seems like a very easy decision to make. And that's why I raised in this motion that currently the maximum penalty equates to 0.4% of the median house price in Kingborough. So it makes perfect sense why developers are choosing to flout the law when the law isn't tough enough. And so even if we did have these retrospective development applications which double the penalty, all of a sudden the penalty becomes two-tenths of 1%, rather, you know, so it's really, these are such measly fines in comparison to the damage that's being done and, importantly, in comparison to the profit that's being made. So that's why we need to disincentivise this behaviour, and that's why a register would work. Are we doing enough to disincentivise developers from profiting off their malfeasance? I don't think we are. It was interesting to hear this conversation around privacy. Well, development applications are publicly released, so the addresses are all publicly released anyway, and we don't seem to have a problem with the privacy related to DAs that are on the public record that anybody can see. So it's interesting that now when we're talking about offenders, we have this real fear that planning and environmental offenders you know, need their privacy too. Well, if you're not familiar with the planning scheme, that's fine. But this idea that you're allowed to break the rules just because you're a mum and pop developer, there are consequences. If you drive through a red light, try and tell the police officer that you just didn't understand the rules. The police officer will fine you nonetheless, and they'll probably say, get off the road until you understand the rules. And I think the same is true for development and environmental offenders. Just because you didn't understand you weren't supposed to drive through the red light, that doesn't mean you're allowed to get away with driving through the red light. There are rules. We have rules for a reason. And so, ultimately, whose side are we on? I brought this motion to recognise the problem that there are some developers who are making money laughing in our face as they flout the rules. And it seems like, to take this approach of therapeutic jurisprudence, it's funny how we have to take therapeutic jurisprudence only when it comes to multimillionaire developers. And who are the losers here? Well, it's the community yet again, and it's the environment yet again. So that's why I'm standing up for this. That's why I'm advocating for this motion. That's why I brought it to the council tonight. What is this council planning on doing about it? Well, if we don't pass my motion, we're planning on doing nothing. And that's not good enough. So please, let's endorse this motion tonight. Thank you.
I'm going to put the motion as moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Gladewright. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Against.
A show of hands is required. All those in favour is Councillor Cordova. All those against is Councillors Antoli, Fox, Dean, Bain, Richardson, Street, Gladewright and Reet. The motion is lost. We turn now to page 104. A notice of motion headed Register of Interests, moved by Councillor Cordova. It has a response from a Mr. Smee. I'm looking for, I've got a mover in Councillor Cordova. I'm looking for a seconder. Councillor Gladewright. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. And once again, thank you to the Deputy Mayor for doing the heavy lifting. Even if you don't support these motions, it's a good idea to just have the discussion. This one is even more straightforward than the last, which is that state and federal members of government, members of Parliament, they have to release their register of interests, and at local government we don't. And I think the central question here, and I anticipate hearing it tonight, is that local government is different from the other tiers of government. And I absolutely agree that we are under less scrutiny, that our responsibilities are totally different, that we have different models and methods of doing things than state and federal. So they're not exactly comparable. However, again, when it comes to community expectations, the councillors are passing motions and voting against things and voting for things that do materially affect the day-to-day lived experience of the residents of this municipality. And I think it's not too much to expect that we publish our register of interests on the internet so that other people can see it. I note the officer's response here that I just think that what we're trying to do is meet a set of community expectations, which are in fact defended by our own strategic plan. We have those standards of accountability and excellence, and I think that we should be transparent, and I don't think we have anything to be afraid of in being transparent. And by holding ourselves to the same manner of account as state and federal politicians, I think is no bad thing, because let's be honest, they're not setting the bar particularly high, are they, when it comes to their transparency and publicising their register of interests. I just think that we could lead the way as this council. We are leaders in so many other different aspects, and we should be proud that we are willing to stick our neck out and be the first to move on some of these things. I'm aware that Legat should or could or will consider this idea, but again, I think that we are leaders, and I have great faith in this council to lead the way. And I think the community would respect us all the more for it. So I hope that we're willing to undertake this this proposal, which would publish the register of interests that we already have, and it would publish it in a similar manner to state and federal politicians by making it available on the internet for anybody who would like to see, you know, what our councillors are involved in. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Before I go to Councillor Dean, I just wanted to make my contribution. I certainly support the intent of this motion, and in fact, you may recall that when Minister Nick Street, the Minister for Local Government, was here meeting with us on, I think it was the 16th of January, I asked him this question specifically about whether a register of interests would be developed for local government, because I indicated to him that if it was not, then I would certainly bring a motion before this council that we should do so. But Minister Street said that in the upcoming amendments that they would be bringing to the Local Government Act, that this would be mandated for all councils across Tasmania. So I believe that we should wait and be part of that. He certainly agreed that it was a matter that we should look at. I guess I'm a little confused by... I'm confused by two parts. One is, I believe you said during the debate that you didn't think that other levels of government, like state and federal government, acted transparently enough, yet you're recommending we do exactly what they do in publishing a register. So that is kind of, that confuses me a little bit, because you said they're not transparent enough, but we should copy them and do their register. So I'd be interested in your response to that in your summing up. The other issue I have with this particular notice is that you're actually suggesting that we publish our current register of interests that we have. The register of interests that we currently have does not fulfil what I believe you're trying to achieve. I believe that it's perfectly reasonable for anybody who holds an elected position to declare their sources of income, their investment properties, et cetera, as state and federal government, state and federal representatives have to. The related party disclosure that we have at the moment doesn't do that. That is an annual return that we fill out, and that asks people to declare any direct relationship with somebody that they have, say, a close sibling or a spouse or a parent or someone else who holds a role that in an organisation that council could be doing business with. Because obviously that would be, for example, your brother is your brother may be the director of a company that is applying for a tender for council, and obviously that is something that we would want to have known. And I think what you're trying to get at is something, you know, more broad, and that is my understanding, is that that is what the state government will be putting in place. So whilst it would be nice to get in early, I think that the process is already in place. I have got faith in the state government, given the commitment that the minister did provide to us here only a few months ago, that they will provide a model register that we would then all populate, and I would hope that we would have that sooner rather than later. So I won't be supporting this motion, but I do appreciate the intent behind it. Councillor Dean.
Yeah, look, I echo your comments there, Mayor, but obviously when you're not supporting something, I feel it's respectful to speak to it and not just fall in behind others. So, look, I actually agree with nearly everything Councillor Cordova has said here around the need of having a register of interests. Having more accountability and transparency of us as elected representatives is a great thing. And as you've outlined, there's discrepancy between local government and the other two levels of government that currently exist. That's absolutely spot on. I want to see it change as well. I do want to see a more robust register interest for us. But, you know, in light of the prospect of this potentially being legislated at a state level, not too far away, potentially, I'm hesitant to support this at the moment, have staff, you know, pursue more time on the matter. Like you said, leading the way is a good thing. I'm 100% agree, but I don't want to lead the way at the expense of wasting council resources unnecessarily if it can be avoided. And I raised this issue with the Mayor last year during the campaign and wondered about it, and so I absolutely support it. I think it's just fair to allow the government actually the opportunity to make good on a promise that Mayor Reid has kind of not a promise. That's probably the minister might be a bit peeved for that word there, but I will retract it. But the intention of potentially putting together a register that's a bit more robust than we currently have. So I'm happy to let that play out, and hopefully, if it's in the mayor's interest, whether we do a follow-up communication to see how it is tracking in the interim. Mm. But if this were to come up again in a few years when it hasn't been legislated, I'd be more than happy to try and lead the way.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. I'd certainly be happy to take up that suggestion. Councillor Gladewright.
Thanks, Mayor. Yeah, look, I wholeheartedly support a register of interests as well, but I think in this case we need to be guided by state legislation.
Any further discussion? If not, I'll come back to Councillor Cordova to sum up.
Thank you, Mayor. So we've heard a lot of councillors, and I really do thank councillors for expressing themselves. We've heard a lot of councillors say, look, I support it wholeheartedly. I support a register of interests and publishing it, but I'm just not willing to support it tonight. So then the question becomes, OK, so we're sitting on our hands until the state moves, the state government moves. How long are we willing to wait? 6 years, like the planning scheme? How long are we willing to wait? 6 months? I'm making a stand tonight that I'm not willing to wait one more day. I don't think we should wait 6 months, 6 years, 10 years for the state government to figure out what they're doing and to make this in the interests of public transparency. I think we can do it tonight. We should. And every minute that we don't, there will be motions that come before this place that are related to whole dwelling short stay accommodation, that are related to many different issues that directly impact the experience of the people who live in our municipality. And I think it is of public interest to know where the councillors, what interests they have. Now, the question about what should exactly be in this register of interests, well, we have heard that the related party disclosure is not particularly robust. And we've also heard that, and I just want to deal with that point, that this motion is for publishing a register that is the same or similar to state or federal politicians. So obviously we're not talking about just our related party disclosure policy, we're talking about creating a more robust, a more improved version of it. So then that brings me to the next point, which is, as the Mayor asked me to respond to that idea, and I'm genuinely engaging with it. I agree, I think that state and federal politicians need to do more. They shouldn't take corporate donations. They shouldn't. They should be transparent with live disclosure. But also they have a register of interests. So as that old phrase goes, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. When I say that state and federal politicians can do more, that's true, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do anything. Just because they're not doing a good enough job as it is and they have a register of interests, we should get a register of interests and then we can also strive to do more. We need to start somewhere. So let's not wait until we find perfection in Shangri-La with state and federal politics that's, you know, at this amazing ebb of transparency. Let's actually act now and do what we know we can do, which is implement and publicise a register of interests, the same or similar to state and federal politicians. So the question ultimately is, are we doing enough right now? I don't think we are. I think there is an unmet community expectation, and I don't think we should let the perfect be the enemy of the good in this scenario. I think we can act tonight, and then if Legat comes back or if the state government comes back with an idea that's better than ours, we'll simply adopt, adapt and improve. We will simply, you know, fix it when we need to. But for every day that we don't publicise our register of interests, we're actually doing a disservice to the community because we're not, I believe, fully committing to what is in our strategic plan when it comes to excellence and accountability. I think this has been a good discussion, and I think if it is going to be mandated by the state government, it might take a long time, and I would rather fix it right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. I'm going to put the motion now. It's moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Gladewright. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Aye.
Show of hands is required. All those in favour? Is Councillor Cordova. All those against? Is Councillors Antoli, Fox, Dean, Bain, Richardson Street, Gladewright and Reid. The motion is lost. We move now to Where do we move to? Page 105. Confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved Councillor Fox, seconder Councillor Glade-Wright. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. In accordance with Kingborough Council Meetings Audio Recordings Guidelines Policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease. Open session of Council adjourned at 7:54 p.m. I'd like to thank